Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, reports that the surge in Iraq is working are commonplace, but they rarely confront the question, working for whom? In his latest piece, Reality is Totally Different, Iraqis on Success and Progress in Their Country, independent journalist Dar Jamail goes beyond the official Washington view and asks Iraqis how the surge is working for them. We'll talk to Dar Jamail. Also on the show, it was not just the fiascos of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, but years of citizen activism that scuttled the U.S. love affair with nuclear power in the 1980s. Now, activism is trying to bring nukes back, but this time it's a huge, highly financed campaign by the nuclear industry and its government allies. We'll uncover the myths behind their message with Carl Grossman, journalism professor at SUNY College at Old Westbury and author of several books on nuclear power. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Indonesian dictator Suharto died on January 27th, and the U.S. public got a demonstration of how the press choose to remember a close U.S. ally who happened to be a ruthless dictator responsible for the deaths of at least hundreds of thousands of people. Obituaries in the New York Times and Washington Post called for caution in assigning Suharto blame. Speaking of the bloody purges of suspected communists in the 1960s, the Times argued, quote, his precise role in the violence is not clear. He managed to keep his name from being directly attached to it, close quote. The Post reported that, quote, no evidence has surfaced that Suharto directly ordered the killings, close quote. The language is revealing, if not astonishing, given that the record on these atrocities has been clear for years, and yes, sometimes even dictators refrain from attaching their names to killings carried out by their armed forces. In 1975, Suharto invaded and annexed East Timor, leading to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Timorese over two decades. These events were rarely covered by the U.S. press, and the Times keeps up that tradition, devoting only a passing sentence to East Timor in their obituary. Perhaps the Times considered it tough words when they acknowledged that, quote, the United States, along with much of the rest of the world, showed a willingness to overlook the corruption, favoritism, and violations of human rights, including the disappearance of opposition politicians that came to characterize Mr. Suharto's rule, close quote. But that blurs some important distinctions, attributing a failure to notice Suharto's crimes to much of the rest of the world as if that were comparable to the act of U.S. support, including military aid, for Suharto's regime.
CBS's 60 Minutes publicized a January 27th interview with the FBI agent who interrogated Saddam Hussein as significant in addressing the puzzle of why, as a January 24th CBS Web article put it, quote, Saddam still wouldn't admit he had no weapons of mass destruction, even when it was obvious there would be military action against him because of the perception he did, close quote. In the interview, after describing Saddam Hussein as, quote, a man who drew America into two wars and countless military engagements, close quote, 60 Minutes reporter Scott Pelley asked FBI agent George Pirro why Hussein had refused to reveal the secret that Iraq no longer possessed weapons of mass destruction. Pelley asked Pirro to describe what had become of those weapons.
He told me that most of the WMD had been destroyed by the UN inspectors in the 90s, and those that hadn't been destroyed by the inspectors were unilaterally destroyed by Iraq.
He had ordered them destroyed?
Yes.
So why keep the secret? Why put your nation at risk? Why put your own life at risk to maintain the charade?
But there was no charade. Iraqi government officials repeatedly asserted at the time that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, as 60 Minutes might have known if they'd watched another TV news program called 60 Minutes 2. It was, in fact, on that program that Saddam Hussein gave one of his clearest statements about Iraq's WMD on February 26, 2003, when host Dan Rather asked him if he still possessed such weapons.
Saddam also rejected Bush administration allegations that besides the missile delivery system, he still has weapons of mass destruction.
I think America and the world also knows that Iraq no longer has the weapons.
Sounds pretty clearly stated for something he was trying to keep secret.
On January 17th, CTV Television in Canada reported that an official Canadian government guide for diplomats put the U.S., Israel, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Mexico, Syria, Afghanistan, and China on a watch list of countries where prisoners run the risk of being tortured. News that the U.S. and Israel were included on the notorious list precipitated a minor scandal and prompted protests from the U.S. and Israeli ambassadors to Canada. But you wouldn't have known that from the Washington Post, where Counterspin listener Ralph Bonheim noticed something missing from the paper's January 19th account. Namely, the paper omitted Israel from the group of countries it listed. Bonheim wrote to the Post ombud, Deborah Howell, about it, noting that other news outlets treated the inclusion of Israel as no less newsworthy than the inclusion of the United States. In her response, Howell cited tight deadlines and limited space before explaining, quote, "It's not that Israel is not important, but other countries were not mentioned as well. Israel is not the next-door neighbor of this country, nor its largest trading partner," close quote. Which was pretty strange, since none of the other countries the Post included fit that description either. The next day, after the Canadian government bowed to protest, the Washington Post ran a story headlined, "Canada to remove U.S., Israel from list of nations that torture," which must have seemed odd to readers who never knew Israel had been on the list in the first place.
A front-page story in the January 28th New York Times made a claim that was so bold and so off-base it led media watchers to call for a correction. In the page one White House memo, reporter Cheryl Gay Stolberg asserted that George W. Bush, quote, "has spent years presiding over an economic climate of growth that would be the envy of most presidents. Yet, much to the consternation of his political advisors, he has had trouble getting credit for it, in large part because Americans were consumed by the war in Iraq," close quote. In reality, few modern presidents would want to exchange their record of economic growth for George W. Bush's. Gross domestic product, the standard measure of growth, increased at an average annual rate of 2.6% from 2001 through 2006, the latest year available. This ranks this White House sixth out of seven administrations since 1960 in terms of economic growth. Only Bush's father presided over slower annual growth. That's just GDP. If you look at other measures of growth, such as wages, employment, consumption, or investment, research indicates the expansion under George W. Bush has been notably weaker than most other post-war recoveries. Only in growth of corporate profits has the Bush expansion shown a higher-than-average rate. Stolberg's take on Bush's economic record seems to reflect the spin she's receiving from those consternated political advisors she cites, but it doesn't match the facts. No word so far on whether the Times thinks that needs correcting.
Finally, last week we noted that USA Today had twice written about a small protest held by a group called the Nationalist Movement without noting that the organization advocated white supremacy. Instead, the paper used the group's chosen self-description of pro-majority. FAIR asked members of its Action Alert Network to write to the paper to find out why they didn't tell readers where this group was coming from. USA Today's reader editor, Brent Jones, responded, writing, quote, "The simple answer is that the term racist is a judgment, and judgments are open to interpretation. It's the newspaper's responsibility to report only the facts. That way, all sides on an issue can be confident that we're reporting the truth without bias. If we give readers a full, accurate, factual picture, they can form their own judgments," close quote. But in fact, USA Today didn't give readers a full, accurate, and factual picture. They didn't indicate, for example, that this is the kind of group whose website advises its supporters to, quote, "refrain from using the term white American in a context which could tend to legitimize those who claim that there are other types of Americans, such as Mexican Americans or African Americans." Generally, nationalists use the unhyphenated and exclusive word American for themselves and for the American people, and minorities or aliens for others, close quote. There's a word for people who maintain that only whites are really Americans. They're called racists, or sometimes white supremacists. By taking the position that you can't call such people what they are, USA Today is making a judgment that racism is always and only a matter of opinion, such that if you say there's no such thing as racism, no one can prove you wrong. Far from allowing you to report the truth without bias, such a judgment is quite a serious bias of its own.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
As early as March of last year, Iraq War cheerleader Robert Kagan wrote in the Washington Post that the surge in Iraq was succeeding. On December 6th, USA Today enumerated the signs of the surge's success. And politicians, including everyone from White House officials to Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton and supposed congressional dove John Murtha, all seem to agree the surge is working. The stories usually recite declining numbers of U.S. military casualties and civilian deaths and may even allow that many benchmarks and political goals have still not been met, but they rarely confront the question about the surge working for whom. Dar Jamail is the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. His latest report on Iraq and the surge is Reality is Totally Different, Iraqis on Success and Progress in Their Country. Dar Jamail joins us now in the studio. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dar Jamail.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, on January 8th, during a news conference, George Bush declared that the surge was incredibly successful beyond anybody's imagination. But the people you interviewed, Iraqis, could not have seen things differently. Can you outline some of the biggest differences between these two views?
Well, one key jumping-off place that Mr. Bush and the media like to use is the dramatic decrease in the deaths of U.S. soldiers. Of course, this doesn't show anything about the reality on the ground, and especially about what Iraqis are having to endure. And that is really the one example that they can hold up, that there has been a quite dramatic decrease in the number of American soldiers dying. But I think this overlooks so much on the ground. I mean, just the broad brushstrokes of what's happened during the surge. We've had at roughly the same period of the surge, we've had a sevenfold increase in the amount of air power being used in Iraq. We have an ongoing massive number of Iraqis being killed and displaced from their homes. For example, as a direct result of the surge, the number of displaced Iraqis in Baghdad has quadrupled. One out of four people in Baghdad, a capital city of over 6 million people, has been displaced from their homes. The brunt of that has happened as a direct result of the surge. In addition to that, we have really a ghettoization of Baghdad, where neighborhoods have been completely segregated depending on whether you're Sunni or Shia. So this is one reason why, at least in Baghdad, the overall number of Iraqis being killed has dropped, which Mr. Bush likes to talk about. But the reason for this is it's really the end game of the sectarian cleansing from death squads that one could easily argue were initially set up and backed by the U.S. as policy. And so we have entire neighborhoods literally surrounded by concrete blocks and very, very strict control of movement in and out of those areas. And this is really what the situation is on the ground. And of course, that's really flies in the face of these claims of progress made by Bush and much of the media.
Speaking of displacement, 4.5 million Iraqis are either refugees or internally displaced. You mentioned displacement. One of your Iraqi correspondents says that on the issue of displacement, if you disappear the people from a neighborhood, it's easy to keep the peace there.
Exactly. It's a university faculty member that I interviewed for this piece, and she said, yes, these claims of progress and success as a result of the surge being made by people back in the United States. I mean, they're talking about entire neighborhoods where so many people are gone or so many people have been killed, and literally people will leave their homes, and they make it a very important point now to say goodbye in a very sincere and meaningful way, because they literally don't know if they'll see the person again if they leave their home, even to go get some bread or some milk, for example. And essentially, when you talk about places like Arab Jabur, for example, in South Baghdad, that recently had over 40,000 pounds of explosives dropped on it by U.S. warplanes, she said, well, really, we have a situation where the city is, or towns where most everyone is dead, do tend to be a bit more peaceful.
And of course, when neighborhoods are ethnically cleansed of groups that are antagonistic towards each other, you're also going to have a lowering of civilian casualties as well. Well, one of the criticisms that you see in coverage that largely declares success or progress for the surge is that political goals have not been met. From reading your report, it seems like political goals may be far more out of reach than one might imagine from reading mainstream American news accounts.
Well, exactly. And another offshoot of the surge and why it's been a total failure is this U.S. setting up and backing of essentially a Sunni militia that consists of 80,000 people on the U.S. payroll. And this is in direct confrontation with the government in Baghdad of also U.S.-backed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who from the very beginning has vehemently opposed this U.S. policy of backing these Sunni militiamen. Most of them are in al-Anbar, some in Baghdad, but this poses a very direct and real threat to the government security apparatus. And so instead of moving towards reconciliation, which is one of the key political goals, it's deepened and widened already existing rifts between the groups.
Well, militias have been armed and put in charge in many places, as you point out, as some of your correspondents point out, not experts or technocrats. Tell us about the awakening councils, which seem to be successful, but based on a weird measure, I think.
It's a very interesting phenomena, and Mr. Bush spoke of this recently in his State of the Union address, is holding up the awakening groups or the awakening councils as this huge success story in Iraq. He's calling it an Iraqi surge, even, of these people stepping up and taking control of security. And what's laughable about this is that these are the same people, the same resistance fighters that a year ago, some of them less than even a few weeks ago, even were referred to by the military, by the media, as terrorists, as al-Qaeda, as insurgents. And now a year later, 80,000 of these men are being paid between $300 and $350 a month of U.S. taxpayer money to literally stand down and not attack American forces and start to take over security in the various areas where their tribes are. Again, mostly in al-Anbar and a few parts of Baghdad. But that's another really portion of the hypocrisy of the Bush administration holding these groups up as success when really it's a redoing of a policy sort of akin to what Reagan did in Afghanistan covertly during the 1980s.
Your report is so different from reports on the surge in the U.S. press. What do you make, then, say, of a report in USA Today on January 18th that said that 75% of Baghdad was secure and that dramatic gains had been made there? Quoting from that report, the data given by the military to USA Today provide one of the clearest snapshots yet of how security has improved in Baghdad since roughly 30,000 additional American troops arrived in Iraq last year.
Well, the key point of this story is part of what you just quoted, the data given to USA Today by the military. I mean, that really says it all. I mean, of course, the military is always going to paint things as glowing success and progress is being made. And again, as we discussed, Baghdad is a capital city that's been eviscerated, one out of four people displaced from their homes, the ghettoization of various neighborhoods. We're looking at a capital city where well over 50% of the people do not have any sort of jobs. How are they even existing? Anyone who can afford to has long since fled. There's just nothing left of the capital city. It's not a functioning city in any way. And again, it's a classic case. When reporters won't go out and cover the story themselves or rely more primarily on at least Iraqi stringers, they put themselves, as USA Today does and the New York Times often does and other big outlets, in a position where the one source they have left is the Pentagon. So they're quoting the Pentagon, and then this is what's happening in Iraq, and there's nothing that they'll do to refute that story.
Well, we're running out of time, and this is perhaps a related question, but journalists here at home often justify putting Iraq on the back burner by falsely claiming, as pointed out in a recent FAIR alert, that the war is not among the top concerns of American voters, when it most certainly is. Can you talk about the tendency of journalists in Washington and in Iraq to see the world more from the view of Washington politicians than from the view of average Americans and Iraqis?
Again, it's related to what we were just discussing, I think, in that the journalists, particularly in Iraq, when they won't go out on the street and actually see what's happening themselves, they're left to where they simply are spokespeople for the centers of power. And rather than holding those people accountable by going out even here and let's talk with average Americans and see what they really think. Well, it's a lot easier to sit at home and just take notes from the press conferences and the political candidates, et cetera, and members of the Bush administration. And similarly, in Iraq, it's a heck of a lot safer to just stay put in your hotel, go into the green zone for some military press conferences, and report on the situation from that aspect.
We've been speaking with independent journalist Dar Jamail. His latest book is Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar Jamail, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Quote, nuclear power, for decades perceived as an environmental scourge, is emerging as the cleanest and most cost-efficient source of energy available, a fact conceded even by environmentalists, close quote. Well, that's a whole lot of PR for one sentence, and readers of the Augusta Chronicle could be forgiven for finding it very authoritative, despite virtually every word being incorrect. Similarly decisive yet misleading claims have been popping up throughout the news media, with the theme that global warming requires that we take a new look at nuclear power, which has anyway been popularly misunderstood. Our next guest takes on the supposed new realities around nuclear power in an article for the February issue of Extra, Fares Magazine. The piece is called Money is the Real Green Power. Carl Grossman is professor of journalism at SUNY College at Old Westbury and author of several books on nuclear power. Welcome back to Counterspin, Carl Grossman.
Always a pleasure, Janine.
Well, let's address up front some of the content of this PR campaign, some of the new facts that we're likely to encounter in these stories. And I guess the driving one is we need to take a new look at nuclear power now because it doesn't contribute to global warming.
Yeah, that's like the biggest fabrication, because if you look at the overall nuclear cycle, uranium mining and milling and the enrichment to make the fuel and the entire cycle, there's plenty. It's a major contributor to global warming. And clean, sustainable energy, which is here now, is available to generate power without contributing to global warming. I mean, using nuclear power to deal with global warming is like treating heroin addiction with crack.
Well, and then the other piece besides it being clean is the idea that it's cheap because that uranium that it uses is so inexpensive and abundant.
It isn't so abundant. The uranium that's used in a nuclear power plant is, well, it's a certain isotope of uranium which fissions. In terms of the high-grade ore suitable for production of uranium-230, you're talking decades. 3, 4, 5 decades at the most. I mean, it's comparable to oil supply. What the people in the nuclear establishment have been talking about for years is not using uranium because of this problem, but going to plutonium-239. Problem here is that plutonium-239 is enormously toxic. But beyond that, it's what nuclear weapons are made out of.
To have that sort of substance being in common usage, it just seems inherently dangerous.
Well, it's an enormous proliferation risk, and the breeder reactors that are seen as what has to be built because of the lack of supply, ultimately, of uranium, would have tons of plutonium in them. And if there'd be an accident in a breeder reactor, you're talking about not a steam explosion, as could occur in a light water, so-called light water reactor using uranium, but you're talking about an atomic explosion because of all the plutonium involved.
So not safe and not cheap, again, in terms of resources. But what about the broader economics of nuclear power?
Well, I mean, Wall Street has walked away from nuclear power. It just doesn't regard it as a wise financial investment. Indeed, what the nuclear proponents see as the thing to cause this revival, what they call the renaissance of nuclear technology, has to do with the taxpayer. Indeed, the energy bill that was passed a couple of months ago provides $20 billion. Nuclear industry wanted 50, but now it's $20 billion over the next 2 years for these new nukes that the nuclear industry wants to build.
Well, now the sort of man bites dog element for journalists on this story seems to be that environmentalists are supporting nukes now. You know, go figure. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that. Who are these environmentalists?
Well, that is also regularly not mentioned. The leading so-called environmentalist promoting nuclear power is a fellow named Patrick Moore, who's often identified as a founder of Greenpeace. Turns out he was not a founder of Greenpeace, and it turns out for decades now, after having been an activist at Greenpeace, Moore has been very, very busy as a public relations consultant to the logging and mining and biotech and nuclear and other industries. But again, this is not pointed out when there's a discussion of Moore. In fact, the greening of nuclear power in the New York Times showcased Moore as an example of somebody who's had a change in mind.
Well, you just touched on the enormous dangers potentially involved here, but let's take a step back in history for a moment, because in any conversation you get into about nuclear power, someone is bound to say with complete conviction, no one died at Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. And I wonder if you could just briefly address that, which is such a key piece of this discussion.
Yeah, well, that's been a major disinformation program, because in the wake of the 1979 accident at TMI, and the owner of the plant has been quietly settling claims. People whose loved ones died, they charge as a result of the accident, giving payments of up to $1 million out with a provision that people aren't supposed to talk about it. In terms of Chernobyl, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people dying as a result of the Chernobyl accident. I did an interview with Dr. Vladimir Chernysenko, who was a physicist in charge for several years of the cleanup of Chernobyl. And he talks about ultimately well over 1 million people will die as a result of the Chernobyl accident. We're not supposed to know this.
Well, finally, one of your sources suggests that it's not just that the industry's PR efforts have improved, but as he put it, the natural skepticism of reporters toward corporate claims seems to have disappeared. You're a journalism professor. Is that how you would account for the success of this campaign, at least in swaying a lot of media outlets to the industry view?
Well, in part, it has to do with a whole new generation of journalists who don't know the science involving nuclear technology, but also it very much involves who owns the media. When you have a company like General Electric, which is a major manufacturer of nuclear power plants, owning NBC and CNBC and on in terms of cable, being so deeply involved in media, you can't expect reporters who work for NBC, unfortunately, to do what they should do about nuclear technology.
We've been speaking with Carl Grossman, author and journalism professor at SUNY College at Old Westbury. His article, Money is the Real Green Power, appears in the current February issue of Fairs Magazine Extra. And you can find more of his work on the web at envirovideo.com. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.